The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The Buddha is said to have said that he teaches suffering and the end of suffering. And that is all that he teaches. And so all of his teachings can be understood to either be speaking about helping us to understand suffering, what suffering is, how it comes to be, and how to end it. How can it be possible? Is it possible to end suffering? And in his own practice, he found that it is possible to end suffering as he defines it, which is not necessarily as we define it. And so it's useful to understand what he means when he says it's possible to come to the end of suffering, because it doesn't mean that we come to the end of unpleasant experience. It doesn't mean that we never experience anything that is unpleasant to us. It doesn't mean that the world becomes the place we want it to be. But he pointed to suffering, the suffering that is created in our own minds and hearts as a result of three really powerful forces in the mind: greed, hatred, and delusion. And when we look at it, actually, when we look at the suffering in the world, not only in our own lives, but in the world, when there is suffering in the world, there is a connection to these forces, whether it's from our own hearts and minds or other people. War, poverty, all of the obvious forms of suffering in the world can be traced back to human beings and greed, aversion, and delusion. Well, maybe not. I'm thinking about natural disasters. You know, those happen, right? And yet, how we suffer around those, how we resist things that happen related to natural disasters, that is a piece of suffering that comes with greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the Buddha is pointing to, can we look at and understand the suffering that comes from greed, aversion, and delusion? And when we begin to understand that, then we begin to experience a different life. And the Buddha described the mind free from greed, aversion, and delusion as a mind free from mental pain and grief, a mind at peace. And so this is the promise of his teaching, that we can have a peaceful heart no matter what is happening in the world, no matter what's happening around us. There can be peace in our hearts. And again, though, and I've been saying this in many talks that I've been giving lately, because it's so easy to misunderstand what this peaceful heart is, because our usual thinking about peace means we think perhaps that everything is okay and I don't need to do anything. Can we fathom? We can't fathom how our hearts and minds could be at peace when there is injustice in the world, when there's pain and suffering around us. How can our hearts be at peace? It almost feels like it would be inhuman to be at peace when there's injustice in the world. And yet the peaceful heart that the Buddha is pointing to is not a peaceful heart of non-action, of just settling back and saying, well, things are great the way they are. It is a heart that is open to and resonating with the world, a heart that is not constricted around what's happening in the world, can take it in, and in the taking it in, wants to act in the world, wants to act to alleviate the suffering in the world. And so the peaceful heart is not a non-active heart and mind. It actually wants to engage very fully in the world, but not from greed, aversion, and delusion. And so this is the, you know, kind of a little summary in a way of what suffering is and the side of the Buddhist teachings about how it's possible. What are the ways that we can free ourselves from these forces of greed, aversion, delusion? How do we do that? The Buddha offered many teachings, and I'd say they're kind of summarized or encapsulated in the teachings of the Eightfold Path. A set of tools, practices that help us to understand suffering in our own hearts, help us to find our way to meeting the experiences of greed, aversion, and delusion in our own hearts and minds in a way that will transform them and allow them to release. And in the releasing of greed, aversion, and delusion, we can find that the heart is infused with love and compassion and a joy in connection with our fellow human beings, and an equanimity, an understanding of balance in the mind. And so the Eightfold Path is a set of tools, practices that support us to be able to understand this teaching around suffering, and the understanding of it, not just intellectual understanding. When I say understand suffering, I don't just mean an intellectual understanding, because it's not just an intellectual understanding that transforms us. It is an understanding experientially of what suffering is, that we experience when we recognize greed and aversion in our experience, and recognize that is suffering in our experience. That direct recognition of greed, aversion, and delusion are not useful as a path to happiness. Basically, greed, aversion, and delusion have deluded us into thinking that they are the path to happiness. They are a path to happiness. And when we start to actually look in our experience, using the Noble Eightfold Path as support and guide, we start to see directly for ourselves that greed, aversion, and delusion are not on the path to well-being and happiness. And that is information, that is a transformative process that begins to happen when we touch into that for ourselves experientially. And so the Eightfold Path offers, okay, there's three sections to the Eightfold Path. The first two, wise view, wise understanding, and wise intention, kind of start us with an understanding of what suffering is. And given that we understand something about the greed, aversion, and delusion being the ground of our struggles, then there's kind of an intention towards changing our direction, to not engage with greed, aversion, and delusion, and to try to engage in something else. And so these first two aspects of the Eightfold Path, wise understanding and wise view, are kind of aiming us in the direction of understanding suffering and freeing ourselves from it. This is stepping onto the path, essentially, with some understanding of what suffering is. The next three parts of the Eightfold Path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, are kind of we can look at them as being an exploration of an engagement in the world, of how we connect to our fellow human beings, that if we want to free our own hearts and minds internally from suffering, then it's useful to engage externally with our fellow human beings in ways that do not contribute to suffering in the world. And so these three, wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, are about engaging in relationship in a non-harming way. This aspect is really about not harming. That's the orientation, that we explore the relationship of non-harming with our fellow human beings. And if we have understood something about suffering, then this becomes, you know, the intention to engage with our fellow human beings in this way. It's a very natural outcome of that. And so this is a piece of the Eightfold Path. Something I want to say about these aspects of the Eightfold Path. They're listed in kind of an order: wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. And we might think of them as being a kind of a linear path, but it is called the Eightfold Path. And to me, that kind of speaks to how they connect with each other, that every one of these factors of the Eightfold Path is contingent upon and informs and supports the others. We need wise view and wise understanding in order to engage in this ethical, non-harming conduct. We also need wise effort and wise mindfulness and wise concentration to support our engagement in the world, to recognize when we are beginning to act in ways that are not so helpful. It takes wise effort to help us recognize that and wise mindfulness to help us realize that. And so they're all connected. It's not that it's one leads to the next, leads to the next, leads to the next. They really inform each other. And so I like that. It's called the Eightfold Path. It's like they're folded one on top of the other. And so this last section of the Eightfold Path, the third section, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration, is a kind of tools that support us internally in engaging with the greed and aversion and delusion that's arising here internally before it becomes external. And so we explore in the middle section of the path, the ethical conduct, the non-harming conduct, we explore the external actions of our bodies, how we engage to refrain from killing living beings, refrain from taking what's not given, refrain from harming through sexuality, refrain from false speech. Those aspects are our ethical conduct in the world. And wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration are kind of looking internally. They're looking at what's going on in our minds that may be creating suffering in here, even though it's not necessarily rippling out into the world, but we're experiencing it. And so these are tools that help us to understand internally the struggle, the suffering, the mental pain and grief that happen internally, and how our minds have gotten confused about where happiness lies. So last time I talked about, we've been talking about over the course of a number of weeks, we've been talking about these various aspects of the Eightfold Path. And last week I talked about, a couple weeks ago, I talked about wise effort, the effort to engage with wholesome conduct, wholesome mind states, the effort to cultivate wholesome states and let go of unwholesome states, where wholesome states are defined as those not connected with greed, aversion, and delusion, and unwholesome states are those based in greed, aversion, and delusion. And so this understanding around greed, aversion, and delusion is right in the definition of wise effort. We are looking at, we're making the effort towards the abandoning, the letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion. This requires mindfulness, this next aspect of the Eightfold Path, and this is where I'd like to spend some time this evening exploring wise mindfulness, right mindfulness. So right mindfulness the right piece of it. Mindfulness itself is a very simple, natural quality of mind. It's related to this capacity to be present. And we sometimes talk about it that way, this capacity to know that we know, to be present, in be aware in the present moment of what's happening in the present moment. And so it's connected to this very simple quality in our minds, this capacity to know that we know. But that itself is kind of a neutral quality, that capacity to know that we know. It's in fact, in the teachings, in the text, the Buddha points to the possibility, or points to at times, wrong mindfulness. And so there's right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness. And wrong mindfulness is mindfulness directed by greed, aversion, and delusion. And so one example of this might be a thief in somebody's house. Very present, very aware of what they're doing, of their steps, of every movement, every action, very present for what they're doing. But the motivation for that presence is greed. That is not what we would call right mindfulness. We would call that wrong mindfulness. It is mindfulness motivated by greed. The intention to be fully present so that you are not caught in the house by the owners. And so this understanding in the Eightfold Path that right mindfulness requires a kind of a perspective or a direction. Not any old being aware in the present moment will do, really. That's not what mindfulness is what the mindfulness of the Eightfold Path is about. It needs a direction, it needs a perspective. A perspective that is interested in understanding suffering and understanding greed, aversion, and delusion as being the root of suffering. And so this is important for us to recognize that how we are mindful is what will help us to become free from suffering. We could also frame this understanding, a simple way perhaps to frame the understanding of wise mindfulness. It's connected with this understanding of suffering. But a way to perhaps to speak about it that may be a little simpler for us is, when we are interested in what is arising in the present moment as something that is arising in the present moment, this is a form of mindfulness that begins to aim in the direction of wise mindfulness. This is a kind of right mindfulness, because the person going in the thief stealing something is not curious about being aware of their reaching and their stepping in terms of what is it like to be reaching and stepping? What is it like to be touching and feeling? That's not what they're interested in. They're interested in being very quiet in order that they're not caught. And so they're very aware of their actions in that sense. But they're not so aware of what's the arising, what's being experienced right now in this heart and mind. And this is the place where the mindfulness begins to reflect back to us that greed, aversion, and delusion are not the way to well-being. When we use mindfulness to be curious about what's arising in this present moment, we may notice there's feeling arising in the present moment, or body sensations arising, and thoughts and moods and emotions. And we may notice anger or frustration arising in the present moment. When we open our attention to, what's arising in the present? Oh, anger's arising in the present moment. Can I be interested in anger arising in the present moment as a phenomenon, as the experience of this is what it's like for a human being to be experiencing anger arising in the present moment? That is a completely different approach for being with our experience than our usual habitual way of being with our experience. Usually when we notice something like anger in our experience, we turn our attention to the thing we're angry at rather than being curious about the experience of anger itself. And so this curiosity about, can I know what's happening in the present moment as something happening in the present moment, is taking us to what is arising as human experience. What is the experience of being human with this arising? This frustration, this confusion, this love, this joy, this irritation, this experience of pain in the body, this experience of pleasantness in the body. What is it like to be a human being experiencing that? I really think it was brilliant of the Buddha to highlight this quality as being so helpful. Because as we turn, and it's like, it's such a kind of normal, everyday quality of mind. It's easy to just take it for granted, just that we can know that we know. But the Buddha found in using it in this particular way, that we begin to deeply understand for ourselves what leads to happiness, what leads to well-being in a very deep way, and what leads to suffering. Because when we turn our attention to the experience of anger in the present moment as an arising experience in the present moment, we know for ourselves in the present moment that is not the way to well-being. We feel the suffering of anger. We know this is the arising of suffering. This is not the way to well-being. Now, again, this is connected to what I said earlier about the peaceful heart, because so often, you know, the greed, the aversion, the delusion has motivated us for so long that it's hard to fathom, it's hard to imagine how we might engage in the world, especially in the face of injustice, how we might engage in the world without anger, aversion, greed. How would that even work? It's hard for a mind that has been so informed by greed, aversion, and delusion to understand that there are other things that motivate the heart and mind. Compassion, love, joy, generosity, wisdom can motivate our hearts and minds to act. And so when I say that anger is not the way to well-being, we feel that in the moment. We feel the suffering of the anger. And as we feel that begin to release, as we begin to recognize and understand that that is not a necessary motivation for us, we begin to find and touch into other motivations, wholesome motivations, beautiful motivations of heart that allow us to act, to respond in the world rather than to react in the world. And so I want to share with you, which I started sharing with you during the guided meditation a little bit, one phrase, a phrase from the teachings of the Buddha that kind of describe the quality of wise mindfulness. I started it with the guided meditation, but right now I'll read the whole thing. One abides observing the body as a body, ardent, fully aware and mindful, free from desires and discontent for the world. One abides observing feelings as feelings, ardent, fully aware and mindful, free from desires and discontent for the world. One abides observing the mind as the mind states as mind states, ardent, fully aware and mindful, free from desires and discontent for the world. There's four of these. One also abides observing phenomena is the fourth. We could translate the fourth as that. One abides observing phenomena as phenomena, ardent, fully aware and mindful, free from desires and discontent for the world. So this is the beginning of a famous text where the Buddha basically gave us the instructions on mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness. But this phrase is the kind of the summary of the quality of mindfulness, how we engage with being mindful. And so I wanted to kind of look at some of the pieces of this phrase. I don't know that we'll get through all of them, but there's a few here that really, to me, speak to the perspective of mindfulness. And the first is abides, this word abides. One abides observing experience. One abides observing the body as a body. One abides. The word abides to me, just even the feeling, the hearing of that word can create something, because we understand something about what it means, and words are powerful for us. And so the word, it kind of can resonate through our system in a way. When we hear that word abide, to me it can kind of create a sense of settling back, of relaxing almost. The word itself that's translated as abide is vihara, which means abode or place to live. And so this to me is pointing us to, can we live in our experience? Can we find a home in our experience, in our body, in our minds? Can we be at home here? So many of us are not at home in our own being. And so this is pointing to this possibility and a kind of a pointing us back to rest at home in your experience. Abide. Abide. And observing. Observing what? Observing just kind of looking at experience. This is again pointing to the what we explore in our experience. And in this Satipatthana Sutta, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, he points to the entirety of experience. And so we ultimately observe whatever is coming up in our hearts and minds. Nothing left out. All experience. We're encouraged to be with all experience. Nothing outside of the realm of what we can be mindful of. And yet it does take this particular perspective that I was speaking of being curious about it as something that's arising. And so we can be mindful of anger and confusion and hatred and rage even. We can be mindful of greed and boredom. And we can be mindful of love and compassion and gratitude and generosity. We can be mindful of anything. We can be mindful of seeing, of hearing. The entirety of our human experience, we can be mindful of. And so this abides observing experience, observing experience, and this observing the body as a body, feelings as feelings, mind states as mind states. To me, this is pointing to what I was saying about noticing experience as experience. We notice feelings as feelings. We notice mind states as mind states. Not We notice a mind state in order to do something with it or about it. We notice feelings arising in the body as, oh, this is what's arising in the body. This to me is what this first section of this phrase means. One abides observing the body as a body. The body in and of itself. This human body. One abides observing feelings in and of themselves, just feelings arising, mind states arising. And ultimately in this teaching, all phenomena arising. The next section, the next word is ardent. One abides observing the body as a body, ardent. And this is interesting because it kind of seemingly contrasts a little bit with this ardent, with this abides word. Because ardent brings in a quality of engagement, of connection, of energy in a way. You know, ardent has this quality of heartfelt connection with experience. And so this, to me, again, points to something interesting about this mindfulness that the Buddha is asking us to cultivate. Both abide and ardent. So this is, it's like, can we be relaxed and engaged? So it's not like a la la la, sit back and relax and just like, oh yeah, abide, like the dude abides and whatever that movie was, The Big Lebowski. It's not that. It's not, oh yeah, abide. It's abide with energy, engagement. It's like an upright abiding. It's a landing in with experience. Relaxation and energy are not opposites. We might think they are based on our kind of habitual way of relating to energy, restlessness, and relaxation, settling back. We tend to think of relaxation as being a kind of like, whew, okay, don't need to do anything. But here, the rest, it's kind of a rest and receive, rest and connect. It's a paradox in a way that we can engage with. Can you just feel into that? Rest and connect. It's kind of a koan of our practice in a way, how we might be able to relax, rest, and engage. And one image that I've found very useful in my own practice around this is it's kind of a simile for how we might make a kind of effort that can be relaxed and restful. It's a kind of effort that's just a light touch of effort, just enough in this moment. Like, connect with an in-breath right now. How hard is that? Can be with an in-breath. Just enough effort for an in-breath. And now, an out-breath. That's all. That's all you have. That's all the effort you need to make. And now, another in-breath. So just this light touch, moment after moment. Just a light touch. The simile that came to my mind a few years ago around this is this simile of a little kid riding one of those scooters, those kick scooters, not a motorized scooter, but you know, one of those ones you put your foot on the platform and then you have to tap on the ground to get the scooter going. So you could stand on that platform, put your foot down and try to push really hard in order to get the momentum for the scooter going, but that'll probably create a pretty wobbly ride. It's more effective to put your foot down and tap, 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 really gently. Tap, 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 just a light touch, light tap. And then you can ride for a while when the momentum comes, when the momentum gets going. This is kind of the way that we can connect with the level of effort for mindfulness. Just enough effort for this moment and this moment. Just a light connection, but a connection. And that begins to get a kind of a momentum of mindfulness, like the momentum of the scooter gets going. And then we begin to recognize, begin to get familiar with this quality of what it's like to be present for a little while. It's like we're riding the scooter. We know what that's like, and we know when we're riding the scooter when it begins to get wobbly. We know the feeling of it getting wobbly, and so we put our foot down and tap again. And likewise with the mindfulness, just a light touch connecting. Can I be with an in-breath? How about enough energy to be with an out-breath? Just a light touch for this moment. Just enough. This moment. This moment. This moment. And we begin to get a sense of what it's like to be present. And we may recognize at a certain point that we can kind of ride a wave of mindfulness for a little while. Maybe we get to just be with an in-breath and an out-breath and an in-breath without even trying. And then need to connect again. And so this light touch, connect, connect, connect. Not a heavy forcing. I need to clamp down and stay with that breath. I've got to hold on to it. But just a light touch. This is the kind of abide ardent to me. That this is what I have found has been so helpful in my practice. I started my practice with so much kind of clamping down and trying to force myself to stay with the breath. And when I learned to settle back, and just enough, just the light touch, just enough for this moment and this moment and this moment, then the mind began to get a sense of that momentum for the mindfulness. The light touch over and over again. The next word or set of words is fully aware. One abides, observing the body as a body, ardent, fully aware. So to me, this phrase, there's some ways this is defined, a couple of different ways this phrase is defined in the teachings. And one of them has to do with kind of going about our everyday lives. It doesn't say what fully aware means, but it says that while we're doing things, while we're walking, while we're standing, while we're sitting, while we're eating, while we're laying down, while we're doing everything, and it even includes urinating and defecating in the text, so everything, nothing left out. Again, all parts of our human experience are included here. I love that, actually, that is in there. So that it says we engage with that in full awareness. So the meaning of that some of the later commentaries give it, is that we engage in those activities knowing, like having our purpose in mind. Why are we doing these things? What is our motivation for being engaged in what we're doing? So fully aware of doing what we're doing and why we're doing what we're doing. So that's a piece of this full awareness, is understanding the purpose for which we're engaged in our activities. But there's another place where it talks about kind of a deeper connection with wisdom. That this is a place where the definition for wise mindfulness begins to point to seeing very clearly. And it says, full awareness is understanding experiences as they arise and they remain present and as they pass away. So basically, understanding experience is impermanent. That all experience arises, persists for a little while, and passes away. This is, we are encouraged to know experience from this perspective. So the full awareness here is an inclining to recognize not only what is arising in the present moment, but that it is impermanent, that it is arising and passing. So this is bringing in some more of the wisdom, because this piece of understanding, as we begin to recognize the impermanent nature of experience, it begins to undermine why we would engage in greed and aversion. Because greed and aversion are kind of caught up in the delusion that I can get something, hold on to it, and greed in particular, so I can get that thing and have it, and that'll make me happy. Aversion also, you know, and get rid of this thing, that'll make me happy. So, but the greed, you know, this kind of sense of having something and connecting with that is what will make me happy. Well, with the seeing of this impermanent quality to all experience, we begin to recognize that the kind of happiness that comes with getting something that we want, as well as getting rid of something that we don't want, that kind of happiness, and there is a kind of happiness that comes from getting what we want. We get something that we want, and for a little moment, we've got the sense of, yep, got that. That feels good to have that. But the seeing of the impermanent nature of experience really begins to point out to us that the happiness that comes with greed, getting what it wants, with aversion, getting rid of what it doesn't like, that happiness is very fleeting. It's not a very reliable kind of happiness. And so this encouragement is pointing to seeing that kind of transient nature of experience begins to undermine the whole motivation, the whole kind of mode that greed and aversion operate from. They operate from a kind of a delusion of permanence, a delusion that I can get something and it'll last, that I can get rid of something and it will stay gone. So there's this kind of delusion around permanence that's tied up with greed and aversion. And seeing that impermanent nature of experience begins to undermine the whole ground that greed and aversion grow out of. This is delusion, really, that we take things to be more lasting than they are. And so this is undermining that ignorance of believing things to have more solidity than they have. Everything in our experience is so transient, so fleetingly transient. We do not have any idea about that until we really start looking at experience and in our meditation, just how fleeting experience is. Our minds are constructing a sense of stability in the world that's useful for there to be this kind of sense of stability. It's useful for us to, actually, when I look around this room, and I know this, and I can kind of experience it a little bit as I look, it's like every movement of my head, it's like the chairs jump around. And you can see this with the camera as it's moving. I mean, they kind of can make you seasick when a camera is doing its kind of whatever that. Then there's some kind of name for the camera that's the observer that's like a person's observing. It's jumpy. It's disturbing to see just how unstable the camera can be. But with our eyes doing that, our mind creates stability in the world. As I do that, it doesn't feel to me like the chairs are jumping around and that you're like going like this. It feels very stable out there. This is our mind creating that kind of, it's using perception to create a kind of a stability out there. This is an amazing function in our minds, this way that perception works. But it is our minds creating that stability. It's our minds creating that sense of something out there that's solid and stable. I mean, even things like this table, you know, It's here. It's not like it's like going to disappear in the next second. But what is pointed to in this seeing experience as impermanent in this way is not seeing that this table really is impermanent. I mean, the table is impermanent. It came into being at some point. Some tree, many trees probably participated in the creation of this table. I think this is like sawdust, you know, glued together. So it's like at some point the particles in this table were a tree. That tree got cut down, milled, this table got put together. So there is impermanence in this table. It is, and it will at some point be gone in whatever fashion. It's already starting to get little things like, you know, falling apart here, but it's still pretty functional. But this kind of, and so we can reflect actually on impermanence of things in the world in this way, and that can be useful for us. But the impermanence that's being pointed to here is the impermanence of experience. The experience that I have of this table is the sight of this table, the contact with this table. The only thing that I can know about this table is in experience, is arising in my own mind. And that's kind of hard to take in, kind of hard to really grok, that all that I experience of the world is a construction of my own mind. And so beginning to see this, that our minds construct what we experience, another piece of that construction that we start to see and recognize is that all that we experience is a construct of our minds. There's a huge area or room for delusion to get in there and shape what we're experiencing. And so we're not just experiencing what's out there as purely what's out there. We are experiencing what's out there filtered through our history, our conditioning, our views, our ideas, our opinions. We are taking in things and not taking in other things. And so our perception is shaped by our ideas and our views and our opinions. And so this receiving of the world is it's useful, it is really helpful to begin to understand and recognize that the receiving that we experience is a construct of our own mind, and that experience is coming and going. This helps to undermine the mind that thinks it needs to cling, that believes it can cling and hold on to or push away experience. There's a lot in this understanding, this wisdom understanding of impermanent nature of experience. But as we do understand that at a very profound level, as we begin to understand that in a deep way, that is one of the most transformative aspects of this practice, because it so clearly shows us the way that we have been living our lives by trying to hold on to, push away things that are not permanent, this kind of unreliable nature of the way we've been living our lives, unreliable way that we have been trying to find happiness. The seeing of the impermanent nature really points out to us that the way we've been going about it is just not useful. So these aspects of mindfulness, right in this phrase, one abides ardent, one abides dwells, observing, the body is a body, ardent, mindful, fully aware, encompasses a lot. It's a lot for us. And yet, this perspective that I mentioned at the beginning of, so we can kind of, we don't have to hold on to all of these definitions, but just kind of keep to this simple definition of understanding what's arising in the present moment as something arising in the present moment. Just keep reminding ourselves, remembering. When we get caught, when we get stuck, when we're feeling a struggle of some kind, usually we are not simply recognizing, oh, what's arising right now is frustration. We are caught by the frustration. We're believing the frustration. And so the suffering of that can help to remind us or point us to, oh, can I know this as frustration? Can I know this as just something happening in the present moment? This simple understanding of mindfulness takes us basically, or holds kind of all of these aspects, helps us to see this receiving of experience, this dwelling, this abiding, helps us to connect with observing our experience, connects us with some energy and connects us with experience, that ardency, helps us to be curious with a piece of this seeing of the being fully aware of experience, a piece of that that's also being pointed to there is really this continuity of mindfulness, because the seeing of the impermanent nature of experience is much more possible as the mindfulness gets more continuous. And so it is encouraging us to be curious about our experience over time. One of the last section is free from desires and discontent for the world, that this is the other piece of the perspective of wise mindfulness. And this one, for me, when I first heard it, it's kind of like, if I have to start free from desire and discontent for the world, I'm not going to ever get there. And we're not going to be able to start from that place. The understanding of this phrase, there's been different people that have argued about this phrase, or, you know, said it basically means you're already at, you know, access concentration and you've got a stable mindfulness here. That's what this, you cannot have wise mindfulness without this stability of mind. And so all kinds of people arguing about what this phrase means. I like one person's interpretation, Bhikkhu Inalio. He points out that the verb that's being used here, frees, one is free from desires and discontent for the world, is an active verb. We could use the, I don't know what the gerund, is that the word where you have the ing? So freeing oneself from desires and discontent for the world. So that essentially this verb is happening simultaneous with this process of wise mindfulness. And so the exploration of abide, observing the body as a body, ardent, mindful, fully aware. One frees oneself, or one is freeing oneself from desires and discontent for the world. That this is how that freeing happens. It's a process that happens with wise mindfulness. That to me is kind of like, oh, good, okay. Because, yeah, there's greed arising in the mind. And if this is the definition of mindfulness, that desire and discontent can't be there, then how can I be mindful of greed and aversion? And it's very clear later in this text, the Buddha actually says, be mindful of greed when it arises in the mind. It's very simple instruction. It says, when greed is arising in the mind, one knows that greed is arising in the mind. When aversion is arising in the mind, one knows that aversion is arising in the mind. And so later in the text, it's very clear that we can be mindful of these difficult mind states, these root qualities that lead us to suffering. And that is what is required for the wisdom, the understanding about them to grow. As I said earlier, as we see anger arising in the moment, as anger arising in the moment, we feel it, we understand it as suffering. And that begins to give the mind a different perspective on anger itself. And it's like the mind begins to let go of that. It begins to release the greed, the aversion, the delusion. And so the releasing, the letting go, the abandoning that we spoke about last time in the wise effort, the abandoning, the letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion, that happens as a result of being mindful of it in this way. It can happen that way. And we do need to take care, because there are times when those are more powerful. Those greed, aversion, and delusion are more powerful than our capacity to be mindful. And so we may have to step aside or put something down for a little while. So I'll just repeat this phrase one last time. One abides contemplating the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, freeing oneself from desires and discontent for the world. This is the Buddha's encouragement for us with wise mindfulness. So the next time I'm back, I'll go into the four foundations in a little more depth, what the actual those four sections are. So thank you for your attention.